Well, good morning, everyone. It's so good to be with you. Most of you know that a dear friend of Philip's died up in Virginia, and he was asked by his family to perform the service, funeral service this afternoon. So that's where he is, and so I'm in here covering for him, and Brother Darrell will be preaching the sermon this afternoon, or this after in the worship service. So it's good to be here with everyone, and so thankful for your presence. We're going to be in 1 Samuel 17. If you'd like to turn there, you may. And Philip started and taught most of chapter 17. We're going to overlap just a little bit, just because I love some of the text there. And don't mind hearing it again and reading it again. But we're going to try to get on to 18 and 19. So 1 Samuel 17, 18 and 19. Of course, the wonderful, perhaps one of the best known and best loved stories of the Old Testament, David and Goliath. And rightly so. It was a turning point in many ways, particularly for David. Lord, we're so grateful for the blessings of each and every day, thankful for these Christians that have turned up this morning to listen, to be attentive, to grow in their knowledge and the grace that you provide through your word. Help us to apply to our lives and make the most of every day that we have to live on this earth. And glorify you in the process. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. So by this time, Saul had really already been rejected by God. But he's still in the position of king, even though David has been anointed. Jonathan, y'all come on this way. Sorry. Y'all, you guys come on in. I was supposed to teach the teen class this morning, but I'm calling them in here because, thank you. Did Hannah go back there? Oh, she's sick. Okay. All right. Sorry about that, guys. I meant to post somebody back there to get you. So again, we're in 1 Samuel 17, so we're going to try to get sort of cover 17, 18, and 19 this morning. So again, Saul has already been rejected by God as being king. He doesn't really know, at least I don't think he does, that David has been anointed king at this time. But it's not as though, David is anointed and then all of a sudden it happens. It doesn't work that way. But David knows this, and he knows that the Lord has given him this position. He's a man after God's own heart. And so, but again, Saul remains in this position as king. But this event with David and Goliath really changes a lot, because it both moves the army of Israel in David's favor, but it also moves the people of Israel in David's favor. In other words, their loyalty and their admiration of Saul has now kind of switched over to David. And David begins to move in and out, and people admire him. And this is like the initial act that puts David on this, larger stage, because, of course, before this time, and as far as I can tell, His life as a shepherd, with his father's sheep is gone. Like, from this point forward, he doesn't go back to the sheep, as far as I can tell. So his life is changing. And so there's almost this emotional response to this idea, and we see this over and over again in the scriptures and in life, in that it's kind of like the, the skinny little, guy in the neighborhood beats up the big bully in the neighborhood. And everybody loves that. You know, everybody wants that to happen because nobody likes a bully. And then, so Goliath was this bully for the Philistines. And David was the youth that, had his way with him and killed him. So we all love this kind of dynamic, and apparently the Lord does too. And it's one of those themes in the Bible, that we see that when people exalt themselves, then we see that they are abased and humbled by God. But when we voluntarily humble ourselves, then God exalts us in his time. And so we see that over and over again, this kind of dynamic going on. So again, this is like a major turning point in David's life. And Saul eventually just loses his mind over this. He becomes almost insane over jealousy and envy over David, because the hearts of the people have gone to David. And, all of those years, we're not going to get to this today, but I'm just kind of laying out like some sections of David's life. All of those years of fleeing and hiding from Saul, when David has done nothing really to be, pursued in this way. But all those years seems in my mind, like just wasted time in so many ways. But David takes it with patience, and he continues to behave himself honorably in all of the, and wisely in all the situations that he gets into. And we see that over and over again. So I want to spend just a little bit more time in the text here. We'll pick up in verses 40. Let's do 45 to 47. And I'll do the reading this morning. I know sometimes we share the reading, but I just want you all to relax and sort of soak in the richness of this text. Yes?
I was going to add to what you just said about being wasting time. Saul, when you're bitter and revengeful and hate, you just kind of lose your mind.
That's true.
I'm going to do whatever it takes. And you wasted all that time?
Exactly. No, you're exactly right, John. If you didn't hear what John just said, he said that when people get into this mindset of being revengeful, of being envious, of being jealousy, it is a waste of time. It really is. That's a really good point, John. I'm glad you. Any other? By the way, I've got some questions coming, but if thoughts come to your mind, be glad to. Yes.
It causes you to lose your mind, is, I think, the point John was making.
Yeah, it does. You're not yourself.
let's read this. And then I wanted to ask this question. Now, what I wanted to ask, once I read this section, I want you to be thinking about why God would choose this young shepherd to be king of Israel, just based on the text that I'm about to read, which is his response to Goliath's sort of trash talk, as we mentioned before. Just look at this text, and you tell me, I've got some thoughts about this, but why did God choose David? Let's see, 45 to 47. Then David said to the Philistine, "You come to me with a sword, with a spear, and with a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hand, and I will strike you and take your head from you. And this day I will give the carcasses of the camp of the Philistines to the birds of the air and the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. Then all this assembly shall know that the Lord does not save with sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hands." Why did God choose David?
Said it over and over right there.
And what is it, John?
The Lord is the one that's going to be taken care
that's
of.
That's why. Yes.
David had faith.
Yes, absolutely.
And he was a man after God's own heart.
He was a man after God's own heart, and he had faith. And he gives God credit for the victory even before he begins to fight. And that's the faith, isn't it? I mean, he's just on a scale from 1 to 10, if we've got a 1 to 10 scale on faith. David is a 12. Rick.
Well, and I don't want to diminish David's faith, but it does say earlier that the Spirit came upon him.
Yeah.
There's almost some prophetic things happening here in this case. He's being prophetic about what's about to happen.
Right.
But he's trusting in the Lord and going in there.
Absolutely. Yes. That is true. I mean, and the fact that he wants all the world to know that the God of Israel is the God of all the world. I mean, that too is just, that has to say to God, this is my man. He's the one there's this complete confidence in the Lord's victory. And, you know, then and now, we live in a world that is based on sight. People live by sight, not by faith. And even when the odds, you know, in this event and in many others, seem overwhelming against the underdog, God is able to bring victory to the righteous. And so this is just trusting in God and seeking God is something that God wants. And he gives those who do it favor and blessing. And that's really the message of the Bible. I mean, in a few words, is when we trust God, we have faith in God, we believe his word, we believe not only in him, but we believe what he said, we will have blessing and favor in God's sight. I've certainly experienced that. And I no doubt you have as well. I want to continue here in verse 48. Let me just read 48 and 49 for a moment, because I want to pause there for a second and make a little bit more comment about the actual what happens here. So it was, verse 48, "So it was when the Philistine arose and came and drew near to meet David, that David hurried and ran towards the army to meet the Philistine. Then David put his hand in his bag and took out a stone, and he slung it and struck the Philistine in his forehead, so that the stone sank into his forehead, and he fell on his face to the earth." Now, have you ever thought about, like, the physics of this whole thing coming together? And Philip mentioned, and Rick just did as well, that obviously David wanted to give God the credit and the glory for everything that happened, and that is absolutely true. Along with that, though, there is some physics going on here that seems to give the the greatest advantage, I would say, to David. And that is that Goliath is coming towards him, and he is running towards the army of Israel. And he has a sling, and I watched a video of him this yesterday, just partly because I was doing this class and partly because I was just interested in the subject. These slings that are still a part of many of the youths of the Middle East, it's not like a, you know, pea shooter like we used to have, like I used to have, you know, you put a little rock in it that big. No, these rocks have been found where David got his out of a dry bed, apparently, between the two valleys. But these were like closer to the size of a billiard, you know, a pool cue ball, rather than like a pebble. They were large. And also the other thing that I noticed when I saw men actually slinging one of these, I don't know that Goliath was not blindsided by this. I don't know that he was expecting this, because I've seen this illustrated in movies, and you'll see, you know, the person playing David is twirling the thing around like this and finally doing it like that. That's not really the way it works, at least not the ones that I saw. It's more like one action, which is almost like if you're throwing a baseball to the batter, you're putting all your force in one action. And the ones that I saw, this makes more sense to me, that basically the sling is almost an extension of your arm. It's almost as though your arm is longer, and it's using this centrifugal force to fling this large, roundish stone out and with tremendous force. I mean, the gentleman that did the video was able, and he wasn't a professional or anything, but he was able to clock his rock at 200 feet per second, which is really fast. And it could go a long ways. So it's just one, just like that, really fast. So I don't know that Goliath even saw it coming. It's possible that he didn't. But anyway, Goliath was, you know, it was almost like a head-on collision. You know, if you're going down the highway, I don't want anybody to do this or demonstrate. If you're going down the highway at 50 miles an hour, and another car is coming to you at 50 miles an hour, how hard are you hitting one another? 100. Right. That seems to me to be the principle here. That's why, you know, if it was a slingshot, it wouldn't. Our skulls are pretty hard. It would take a lot to actually break a skull.
I've always imagined the stone is disc-shaped.
It could have been. It could have been, yeah. Eventually they started making them out of lead, I learned, and they were shaped basically like a football. And when they would sling this piece of lead out, which was much denser than rock, of course, and heavier, it would actually twirl like a man that throws a football. It orients itself like a bullet, and it becomes even more powerful. So yeah, it's a whole thing, you know, out there related to this subject. But I thought it was interesting, and the fact that Goliath did not fall backward, but which way did he fall? Forward. Which means his momentum was going forward, not backward. He wasn't just standing there waiting to be hit. He was moving forward, and that's why he fell forward on his face. So anyway, just interesting things. Let's read to the end here, verse 50 on to the end. So David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and a stone, and struck the Philistine and killed him. But there was no sword in the hand of David. Therefore David ran and stood over the Philistine, took his sword and drew it out of its sheath and killed him and cut off his head with it. And when the Philistines saw that their champion was dead, they fled. Now the men of Israel and Judah arose and shouted and pursued the Philistines as far as the entrance of the valley of the gates of Ekron. And the wounded of the Philistines fell along the road to Shearim, even as far as Gath and Ekron. Then the children of Israel returned from chasing the Philistines, and they plundered their tents. And David took the head of the Philistine and brought it to Jerusalem, but he put his armor in his tent. When Saul saw David going out against the Philistine, he said to Abner, the commander of the army, "Abner, whose son is this youth?" And Abner said, "As your soul lives, O king, I do not know." So the king said, "Inquire whose son this young man is." Then as David returned from the slaughter of the Philistine, Abner took him and brought him before Saul with the head of the Philistine in his hand. And Saul said to him, "Whose son are you, young man?" So David answered, "I am the son of your servant Jesse, the Bethlehemite." So we see the Philistines. Where was the Philistines' faith at, by the way? Who was the Philistines' faith in? Goliath, right. And when Goliath, a youth, comes and takes a sling and kills him, and the youth takes off his head, where did their faith go? It disappeared really fast, didn't it? Because all their faith was in Goliath. He was our man, you know. And then he's dead, laying on the ground without a head, and their faith just dissolves. And at the same time, though, Israel's rises, and David makes an incredible, they spring into a rush of newfound courage because of this moment that has happened. Whereas before, they went through 40 days of just being bewildered and deflated and not knowing what to do about this, you know. And David completely changed the paradigm here.
No,
according to most of the commentaries, it's like 9'10", 9'10", or so close to 10 feet. So if you think about I'm 6'4", so if you think about someone 3 feet higher than I am, that's a really big person. And I'm sure he was built kind of like Vince over here too. He was, you know, he was brawny. Yes.
I think they call them Nephilims.
Yeah, right. That is a word that's used for the giants, right? The Nephilim. Yeah. So
there were a lot more of them.
Oh, there were a lot more of them. They were the men of Gath. Yeah, Zach.
I one time looked up, like, what would the healthy weight of somebody that size be? And the number I came up with was between 400 and 492 pounds.
So close to 500 pound person. Yeah. And what?
All the armor.
Yeah, without the armor.
Just
with the person, right? So Zach is pointing out a good point here, which is that, you know, like a baby or a child, an adult is not like a toddler that's 6 feet tall. In other words, we grow in proportion to our height as we grow. So these giants, though, were undoubtedly in proportion to themselves. They weren't just extremely tall, lanky people. They were tall and large people that had tremendous strength and ability. So, yeah, close to 500 pounds. So you think about a 500-pound person coming at you. I mean, the odds seem, you know, insurmountable. So, yeah, appreciate that, Zach.
They really matter, but I wonder what their diet was.
I'm sure they ate a lot, yeah. Yeah, exactly, right. So Saul wants to know more about David here, doesn't he? He said, who is it? It's as though he doesn't know who he is, although David has actually been playing the harp in Saul's court before this time. But this is a little bit hard to figure out, but I'm wondering if Saul can't believe it's the same person. Yeah, Rick, do you have a thought?
Well, my only thought is, I mean, you've got this king with all these responsibilities and all these servants. He's got somebody playing a harp for him. He may have even been behind a curtain or something.
Right. Yeah. But another thought that I had is, you know, if someone is really good at something and maybe they're known for one thing, like, you know, when it came up regarding a question about, you know, that Saul was in distress and he was depressed, and he says, we need to find a musician for you, you know, and that'll help. And David's name came up first because he was a musician. And, oh, I know someone who plays the harp well. I'll get him. And so, but people become known for one thing, doing one thing very well. And sometimes those same people do other things really well, but they're not known for those other things. I think this is maybe what's happening with David is he's been pegged as a musician, but nobody knows he's a warrior. Nobody knows that he has other talents that are completely a poet. You know, he's a poet. He's writing all these psalms, which is just amazing to me that he even had time to do this. But David is a man of just, you know, tremendous courage, tremendous gifts, tremendous talents, and he puts them all to use. But his biggest attribute is his faith in God, unquestionably. But God is interested in him, and the scriptures say that God... Saul does not let him go back home, basically. After this incident, Saul wants him in his cabinet, basically. He wants him to be there. So, let me see. Verse 58, we see there again that that David's family is from Bethlehem. And, of course, about 1,000 years in the future, who else will be born in Bethlehem? Jesus, who will be the not just a king, but the king of kings. And so from the lineage of David, we have these little bits of prophetic things going on that are just sort of dropped in, you know, about the lineage of David. So we're going to move on to chapter 18, unless anyone else has any comments about that so far. Okay. So chapter 18, we'll do verses 1 to 9, first of all. Now, when he had finished speaking to Saul, the son of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul. Saul took him that day and would not let him go home to his father's house anymore. There we go. Then Jonathan and David made a covenant because he loved him as his own soul. And Jonathan took off the robe that was on him and gave it to David with his armor, even to his sword and his bow and his belt. So David went out wherever Saul sent him and behaved wisely. And Saul set him over the men of war, and he was accepted in the sight of all the people, and also in the sight of Saul's servants. Let me see where I was going to... verse 9. Now it happened as they were coming home, when David was returning from the slaughter of the Philistine, that the women had come out of all the cities of Israel, singing and dancing to meet King Saul, with tambourines, with joy, and with musical instruments. So the women sang as they danced and said, Saul has slain his thousands, and David his 10,000s. Then Saul was very angry, and the saying displeased him, and he said, they have ascribed to David 10,000s, And to me they have ascribed only thousands. Now what more can he have but the kingdom? So Saul eyed David from that day forward. So Jonathan is Saul's son. And after this little conversation in the, you know, in the court, and Jonathan just has an immediate love and friendship. He wants to befriend David. And he is very unselfish, like, in this. He takes his robe, his armor, his sword, his belt, all the things that would designate Jonathan as the heir to the king, he gives it to David. So this is rather extraordinary. And Saul later reminds Jonathan of this fact that he, Jonathan, would be the heir apparent to the throne. But this friendship, this close bond with David, Saul is not happy about this because he sees David as a threat to himself and to his heirs, as opposed to glorying in the fact that God has chosen a man that will become king. So we see that phrase there, this disposition towards David changes. And it says there that he eyed David from that point forward. What does that mean? He eyed David. Yeah. The jealousy and the fact that he looked on David suspiciously, as though he's conniving, you know, worming himself into the throne in order to take over. Was that what David was doing? Of course, anything but.
Saul's paranoia.
Yeah, exactly. Saul was paranoid, very paranoid. And as time goes along, we see how David does anything but that. When Saul is out pursuing him in the wilderness and trying to find him in the caves and everything, and he has opportunities to take him, he doesn't. So, no, David is not conniving. He's not trying to manipulate his way in. None of that is true. So, yeah, that's a good word. He is paranoid. So, let me see where we are here. Let's go on to from 10 to 16 at this time. Let's see. And it happened on the next day that the distressing spirit from God came upon Saul, and he prophesied in the house. So David played music with his hand as at other times, but there was a spear in Saul's hand. And Saul cast the spear, for he said, "I will pin David to the wall." But David escaped his presence twice. Now Saul was afraid of David, because the Lord was with him, but he had departed from Saul. Therefore Saul removed him from his presence and made him captain over 1,000. And he went out and came in before the people. And David behaved himself wisely in all his ways, and the Lord was with him. Therefore when Saul saw that he behaved very wisely, he was afraid of him. But all Israel and Judah loved David because he went out and came in before them. So this is, you know, over the top anger of Saul. It is just irrational. And this attempt to murder David for no good reason other than the fact that Israel loved him, you know, there's no sense in it. Saul was almost, in a way, and there's a lot of other parallels that we could make to Jesus, but it seems almost that Saul, in spirit or in sense, was almost like the Pharisees were in Jesus' time, in that they were so consumed with envy and jealousy that they just wanted to kill him. They wanted to get rid of him, just like Saul wanted to get rid of David for envy. The Pharisees wanted to get rid of Jesus because of envy. So we see that, and lots of other parallels that that are like the times of Christ as well. And David, again, there's lots of things we could go into along those lines. I'm going to summarize this next section here because we'll run out of time. But Saul didn't seem to value his daughters very highly. I'll just say it that way. Because first he promises the older one to David, but then he ends up giving her to another man. Then he promises the younger one, Michael, to David, but only it as a snare, it says. He hopes that Michael, his daughter, will be a snare to David. And then he, you know, pronounces this dowry, which is 100 lives of the Philistines, which, you know, the proof of that would be the foreskins of the Philistines. And David brings back 200. So this isn't going well for Saul, is it? That wasn't the plan. The plan was that he would that David would be going out to fight the Philistines, and Saul hoped that the Philistines would kill David. That was what he wanted to happen. But that's not what happened. David killed twice as many and brought back the proof of it. So, you know, this is not going well for Saul. And obviously, God was with David. That's what's said in the scriptures there. So that plan didn't work. And so, you know, Saul becomes the enemy of David continually. And meanwhile, David's name becomes highly esteemed, and everybody loves David. That's verse 40. So Philip wanted me to get through chapter 19, so we'll spend a little bit of time here and see if we can get through 19 as well. So 19 chapter 19, verse 1 through 6. Now Saul spoke to Jonathan that his son and to all his servants that they should kill David. But Jonathan, Saul's son, delighted greatly in David. So Jonathan told David, saying, "My father Saul seeks to kill you. Therefore, please be on your guard until morning and stay in a secret place and hide. And I will go out and stand beside my father in the field where you are, and I will speak with my father about you. Then what I observe, I will tell you." Thus Jonathan spoke well of David to Saul his father and said to him, "Let not the king sin against his servant, against David, because he has not sinned against you, and because his works have been very good towards you. For he took his life in his hands and killed the Philistine, and the Lord brought about a great deliverance for all Israel. You saw it and rejoiced. Why then will you sin against innocent blood to kill David without a cause?" So Saul heeded the voice of Jonathan, and Saul swore, "As the Lord lives, he shall not be killed." Well, what about that oath of Saul? Did that stick? No. He didn't end up killing David, but did he want to? Yes. He wanted to over and over again. For years, he pursued him. So, no, that oath didn't mean very much. We got 5 more minutes. Let's finish on here to and read 8 through 17. "And there was war again, and David went out and fought with the Philistines and struck them with a mighty blow, and they fled from him. Now the distressing spirit from the Lord came upon Saul as he sat in the house with his spear in his hand, and David was playing music with his hand. Then Saul sought to pin David to the wall with the spear, but he slipped away from Saul's presence, and he drove the spear into the wall. So David fled and escaped that night. Saul also sent messengers to David's house to watch him and to kill him in the morning. And Michal, David's wife, told him, saying, "If you do not save your life tonight, tomorrow you will be killed." So Michal let down David through a window, and he went and fled and escaped. And Michal took an image and laid it in the bed, put a cover of goat's hair for his head, and covered it with clothes. So when Saul sent messengers to take David, she said, "He is sick." Then Saul sent messengers back to David, saying, "Bring him up to the bed, in the bed, that I may kill him." Again, what was his oath to Jonathan? That he wouldn't, that he swore to the by the Lord that he wouldn't kill David. And here he is doing everything he can to kill David. And when the messengers had come in, there was an image in the bed with a cover of goat's hair for his head. Then Saul said to Michal, "Why have you deceived me like this and sent my enemy away so that he has escaped?" And Michal answered Saul, "He said to me, 'Let me go. Why should I kill you?'" Of course, that was a lie too. He wasn't going to kill his wife. That was ridiculous.
Notice it says, "My enemy."
Yes, right, exactly. And that's the way Saul sees David right now, as his enemy. So there's a lot to discuss there. This distressing spirit from the Lord, if you have a thought about that, I'd be happy to hear it. I guess I have a thought about it, but if anybody has a thought about it, would like to share it, I'm open to hearing it. What is this distressing spirit from the Lord? Some versions say evil spirit from the Lord, which doesn't seem to make as much sense. Well, here's what I think about it, and I could be wrong about this, but you have to make sense of this somehow. And that is that God is over all realms, including the spirit world. And he is, by nature, his default position is to restrain and disallow demons and evil spirits to act in the realm of men. However, it is possible for, most of you probably seen these leashes for dogs that have like a spool on them and they go out. That's almost like, I would say, God is able to allow the demons so much leash, and he is able to give them permit them to go so far, and then demons do what demons do, which is, create havoc in the lives of men and try to turn them away from God. More than that, it seems like that the demons would have wanted to kill David if they had their opportunity. Rick?
Well, it says in Ephesians that Jesus is above all principalities and powers in the heavenly places. So that kind of goes hand in hand. And we saw that in the Gospels.
Exactly right. Exactly right.
I think about Pharaoh's heart being God.
Yes. Pharaoh's heart. Yes, exactly. And Job, Job allowed the devil to take a certain, amount of space with Job. So we're about out of time. We may have to leave this last part. How close are we, Ken?
We've got another minute.
Another minute or so? Okay. I could take a lot more than that, but, remember that here's something I'll share with you that has helped me regarding this kind of phenomenon that we just spoke of. And that is that God has his perfect will. There's two P words here. And God has his permissive will. He has a perfect will that, when we're in line with God, when we're doing exactly, then that's God's perfect will. God has a permissive will, and this really answers the question a lot of times for unbelievers their main objection to God is, why, if there is a God, why is all this suffering in the world? You know, why do we see all this suffering and calamity if there's a God? Well, God has, here's the point that they don't seem to understand. God has an enemy, and he's called Satan, and he's the devil, and he has his own demons that are under him. So God permits the free will of man to do whatever their free will permits for the most part. And that's why you see leaders like Hitler arise, or you know, Stalin, people that kill millions and millions of people. Well, is that ultimately, is that God's perfect will? No, I don't think so. But it is his permissive will in that he permits it, and ultimately to his ends. So we'll end with that. Thank you. You've been very attentive and made a good class. Thank you so much.